Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Empathy is the fuel of democracy. Our willingness to see each other, not as enemies, as neighbors, even when we disagree, to understand what the other is going through. Democracy must be defended at all costs, for democracy makes all this possible. Democracy. That's the soul of America. And I believe it's a soul worth fighting for. And so do you. A soul worth dying for.
President Biden yesterday, a beautiful shot of the White House this morning. That was the president speaking at Arlington National Cemetery for Memorial Day yesterday. It's good to have you all on board this morning. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Tuesday, June 1st. Along with Joe, Willie, and me, we have MSNBC contributor Mike Barnicle, member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay, and White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, doing double duty this morning.
Wow,
it is too early.
So a couple of things. First of all, it's June. I mean, come on.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. When did that happen? I thought we were like middle of February.
No.
I need to read the paper a little bit more. And look on. So let's
check
the
calendar.
Let's look on SAD. Like, this is, it's incredible. Like, you know.
Look at this
here
shot,
we are,
Joe.
Meek, of course, where we are all the time at the top of our apartment building at 30 Rock. Never left New York. Yeah.
Look at that tomorrow.
On set. And we'll see you there, I think, at some point. How was Memorial Day? Willie, how was your Memorial Day? What did
my
you
coffee.
Do?
Well, unfortunately, I spent most of it watching the Yankees be swept by the lowly Detroit Tigers and plummet to 5.5 games back in the AL East. So it was a cold, rainy Memorial Day here in the New York area for many reasons. But I'm excited. I'm lifted up today by being around the table by these two guys. It's been a year and a half almost since we've had a group this big around the table. So things are coming back.
All right, we're coming.
And I think tomorrow it's going to be like Mardi Gras. We're going to be around the table.
Yes.
We're going to have, we're throwing beads. It's going to be fantastic. Mike, how was your Memorial Day weekend? What did you do?
You know, it was wet, it was cold, but it was wonderful because Memorial Day is one of my favorite days of the year. It harkens back to, brings back so many memories of growing up when Memorial Day was a much bigger day in the sense of memory than it is today, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful to be with the grandchildren, my kids. We were all together. Can't ask for anything much more than that.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
way.
Yeah, Jonathan Lemire.
I spent it in the Cradle of Liberty, Wilmington, Delaware, on presidential pool duty, where it also was cold and rainy like everything else. But I will say, to furthering Mike's point, the president on Sunday addressed in front of the group of Delaware veterans, not just the sacrifice that they and their families made for those lost in service, but he made it deeply personal and spoke about his son, Bo, who himself was a veteran, who had died 6 years ago that day. And certainly this president understands what Memorial Day is all about and the sacrifice that American families have made.
Well, you know, and Bo told us when he came on the set, whenever we talked to him, it was obvious his military service and the friends and colleagues that he knew and lost in the wars. That was he felt like that was the most important thing he did in his life. So obviously it's very personal to the Bidens, just like it is for so many families. Mara, also, as we're watching Joe Biden yesterday, it's so interesting that if I'd heard any president talking about democracy and we need to fight for it 5-6 years ago, I would have said, okay, that's great, but we assumed that's the reality in America for over, you know, why is he talking about
almost
democracy?
Taking offense.
Why is he talking about democracy? And it just really, it's just another sharp reminder of where we are in 2021, that there are illiberal so-called democracies across Central and Eastern Europe. There is a growing totalitarianism across the globe and a growing number of Americans who are saying that they want the election results overturned and they'll even resort to violence, if you believe the polls, to achieve those ends.
That's right. The president is talking about democracy because democracy is under threat at home and abroad. It was even more meaningful when you think that we spent the past 4 years having a president who, I think if we remember, wasn't that long ago, I don't want to misquote him, but I think at some point he called veterans losers. You know, I think there are millions of Americans for whom yesterday was a very solemn day and a reminder that democracy is and freedom are really, truly not free. It's not trite if you've lost someone in war or, you know, if you were out marching for civil rights in the 60s or for voting rights last year or this year. Look at what's happening in Texas. You know, this was an emotional day for my family as well. My uncle Donovan died in 2013 of an Agent Orange-related cancer that he got in Vietnam, right? Wow. And so millions of families have sacrificed to build this democracy and to hopefully expand it. I think a majority of Americans who voted for Joe Biden want to see this democracy endure and expand to be better and to include all of us. And there are illiberal forces, as you said, Joe, that don't want that.
Yeah, and it's so, we're so sorry for your family, but it's a reminder there are so many families that we're remembering yesterday, and not just for those who died in battle, but for those who died from the effects of battle. And we've certainly seen it over the past decade, the past 20 years, the number of young Americans committing suicide that served our country in uniform. And it's just, again, it's something that bears repeating every day about those remarkable sacrifices. Willie, speaking of tried, and I hate to bring this up, I really do, but speaking of tried, you look at the tried attacks at the vice president on Friday. You want to go after somebody because of policy, that's something, but to use Memorial Day because she tweeted, have a nice long weekend. Memorial weekend or whatever. By the way, yesterday was Memorial Day. Let me just educate everybody out there. I know some of you are new at this. Some of you maybe have forgotten what it's like to be Americans. I know the last 4 or 5 years have been sort of destabilizing for you. I didn't say that. Destabilizing for you. Memorial Day was yesterday. Memorial Day weekend's over the weekend. And Willie, what was so remarkable about, remarkably trite and small about the fake outrage that was aimed at Kamala Harris on Friday for a tweet was you just, I think George Conway said, oh, you want to go there? You really want to go there? You want to look at Donald Trump's tweets on Memorial Day about his economy and how great everything's going, et cetera, et cetera. Like nothing to do with sacrifice. A guy who for 4.5 years had absolutely no idea how to connect with those who have sacrificed for this country. It made what happened on Friday all sort of the more trite, the more sad that people were that desperate to attack on this weekend.
Yeah, and as you say, Donald Trump, who many of them probably support if they're attacking Kamala Harris that way, put out a message talking about gas prices for Memorial Day weekend, and remember how great your president, Donald Trump, was, and that the uptick in prices has taken place because of Joe Biden. It turned into an attack on the sitting president. So enjoy the long weekend from Kamala Harris. Obviously, there's some hypocrisy going on there. On a day yesterday, especially, Joe, I mean, there are so many families out there. If you think about, for example, the Vietnam Veterans Wall, my dad fought in Vietnam. He had an experience with Agent Orange that that affected his life and still affects it today. Mike, there are 58,318 names on that wall alone. And when you stand and look at that wall, you can't help but think of the lost potential, the lost futures. I feel that when I look at it, I think about my dad. And if obviously if he were on that wall, there's no me, there's no, my kids aren't around. So there's such a depth to a lot of families in this country for what Memorial Day means.
You know, Willie, first of all, the wall is overwhelming just by itself, overwhelming to look at all the names and to be there and see people finger tracing the names of loved ones lost or friendships ended in Vietnam. And the Agent Orange effect on people still today that was mentioned by Mara. And I'm sure it affected your dad.
Yep.
I know several people who were deeply affected. But yesterday, the importance of President Biden's speech, I think, was a critical component to Memorial Day. The idea of giving a speech on about democracy, sort of defining what democracy meant to him and to us, has long been on his mind, Jonathan, long been on his mind. And he gave it yesterday on the perfect day to give it, especially given the confluence of events around us, the Texas legislature, the whole flap about voting. And I think if you speak to people, and I know you do in the White House, the idea that the Republicans in the United States Senate, he's sort of ignoring the House to a certain extent, but the Republicans in the United States Senate, Jonathan, are such a monolithic block, has surprised him.
Yeah, no question. And defending democracy has been a theme of his, starting with the campaign when he was running against Donald Trump, but also taking office. And he's set the stakes very high, basically saying that America needs to prove that democracy can still work at home in order to be a rival to compete with the autocracies abroad, particularly China, that he feels like we need to prove that this still works, that the American experiment with democracy still works. And certainly part of that message is to the Republican Party and suggesting that democracy means voting. Democracy means what should be, you know, not an insurrection, and therefore in commission to investigate it, which, of course, we saw go down in defeat on Friday. And there has been real surprise and dismay from the president and his advisors. Sure, there have been a couple of Republicans they feel like they can deal with on these issues, whether it's infrastructure, but certainly on the bigger picture stuff. But it's a block that has been incredibly stubborn and difficult to penetrate. And the president knows the stakes are high, and the Republicans, he believes, need to get on board.
So I want to, Mike, I want to bring these two things together for a minute. And I always sound like an old guy, but I always remembered, even, well, that's why I'm going to talk to you, because we're talking about a breakdown of Republicans and Democrats working together, and we're talking about Memorial Day, and these things go together. I remember I came in at the tail end of the time when there were World War II vets, there were Korean vets, there were Vietnam vets, Republicans and Democrats alike, that had this special bond. I'm thinking about John Warner and a lot of the stories that were written about John Warner when he passed away. And this quote stuck out to me. When I began serving, John Warner said, 3/4 of my colleagues were military veterans. We had political disagreements and fought on the Senate floor. But at day's end, we shared a drink, we talked as friends, and we found common cause, solving problems and serving the American public. Obviously, thank God, we haven't had wars on the scale of the Second World War, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. But they're definitely in our lifetime, and so many of these members' adult lifetimes. But that was a bond that brought them together. That was an ability to work together across party lines. Let's take this beyond war, please. We obviously want to avoid wars moving into the future, but there doesn't seem to be the connective tissue. There doesn't seem to be the shared American experience in war or in peace. We seem so divided, and not just in Congress, but in everyday life, staring at phones. 320 million people, 320 million realities, 320 million gods, 320 million religions, 320 million worldviews, it seems, at times. The connective tissue has been torn apart, and that's something that John Warner in his life and his career harkened back to. And there was a connective tissue civically that Republicans and Democrats could be held together, they could be bound by.
You know, Joe, so much of what you just said is so true in this country today. I mean, we have lost touch with one another. We have lost touch with the term neighbors. We have lost touch with the loose connection that bonds us all to that once bonded us all together. You know, towards the end of at the beginning of your service in Congress in the mid-1990s, the collegial effect of having served together in the House and the Senate militarily began to dissipate. It began to disappear. But for many, many years after World War II, the United States Congress, both the House and the Senate, was filled with people who served in the war, in both wars, either in World War II or Korea. I'm thinking about Andy Jacobs from Indiana, former congressman from Indiana. He was a Democrat, but his friends were Republicans. Forget the Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan stuff. There were many, many people who served, Democrats, who served in World War II and Korea, some in Vietnam early on. But they were friends with Republicans because they had a common bond of service to this country. And now that phrase, service to this country, has been lost. Because as you said, we walk around staring at our iPhones. We have all collectively become the other, unfortunately.
Mm. Something we'll be talking about a lot more here. President Biden, though, will travel to Oklahoma today to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Biden will tour the Greenwood Cultural Center this afternoon alongside several of his top cabinet members and advisors. He's also expected to deliver remarks at the site of the deadly violence where a white mob murdered hundreds of black Americans. NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton has more.
Once the site of horrific racial violence, Tulsa's Greenwood District transformed into a community memorial. As residents and visitors marched and honored descendants and the few living survivors, 100 years ago, an estimated 300 black residents of the affluent Greenwood neighborhood were murdered by a white mob. 10,000 of them fled as their homes and livelihoods were destroyed. Nehemiah Frank's family lost their tailor and shoeshine shops in the massacre.
I feel like this is our final chance to put pressure on the city and the state who we feel are responsible for the massacre. And so we feel that this is our final chance to get restitution and repair from the city of Tulsa.
The question of restitution has been the center of conversation and tension as black residents and lawmakers press for reparations.
That's what we're saying out here today, reparations now for those survivors, for the descendants, and then also rebuild Black Wall Street.
But Tulsa's mayor, G.T. Bynum, says payments to survivors would divide the city. He declined to speak to NBC News. In solidarity with survivors, John Legend and Stacey Abrams backed out of a ceremony.
What do you think is the overriding emotion of this weekend?
For the mayor and maybe others, I think that they are hoping that this will wash over quickly and then it's back to regular business for them. For myself, for my community, I feel like it's the sunshine coming in and, you know, shining light on 100 years of oppression and generational trauma.
And you feel like you're still carrying it on your shoulders
today? Oh, without a doubt.
Damien Rozelle's family lost their grocery store in the massacre. He believes Black Tulsans' best hope is to lean on each other for support.
A lot of the emphasis this weekend is on the destruction that took place, but not really the rebuilding. And so holding my granddaughter right here, it's all about the future, not so much about the past.
And rebuild Black Wall Street together against all odds, just as they did in 1921.
And Mara, of course, we've been talking about connective tissue that have drawn Americans together for so long. Of course, Tulsa is a reminder of so many Americans who never felt that connection. And these pictures come back 100 years later as a stark reminder of what has happened in our history and what so many Americans today are still fighting for.
Yeah, it's a really challenging story for several reasons. One of them is just we were talking about veterans and the connective tissue that can build, and that's absolutely correct. Of course, then you look at what happened in Tulsa, and we have images today of hundreds of World War I Black veterans from World War I being rounded up and put into the equivalent of local, concentration camps, and many of them lynched. It's a very harsh, difficult history that really is, I think, still prescient today when you think about we still have survivors from this. You know, the other reason this is an important story is because I think Americans, especially white Americans, but Americans in general, tend to be very good at forgetting history, but also tend to think that slavery was a very long time ago and that discrimination was a very long time ago. The reality is not, that's just not the case. So we have individuals, I spoke actually to Dr. Olivia Hooker, who was one of the last survivors. She died in 2018. I was fortunate enough to get a chance to interview her both when I was in high school and then again at the Wall Street Journal. And she survived the massacre as a little girl. She remembers people walking through her backyard with torches, the mob, as she and her parents hid under their table in the dining room watching them. And she had just gotten a baby doll and she had the clothes for the baby doll that her mother had made and they were hanging on the clothesline. And the mob returned to burn the doll clothes, a baby's clothes, on the clothesline. I mean, that's a story that I got a chance to hear in person. And so I think the connective tissue is also trauma and plunder. And this is not the only town in America where this happened. There's an image of those veterans there, I believe. But it doesn't mean that the American experiment is for naught. What it means is that it's far more complicated and has been far less inclusive than we want to believe. I think that the way forward, of course, as a country together is to acknowledge this history before you move forward. Doesn't mean you have to stay there forever. It means you need to acknowledge it and you need to remedy the pain, whether through reparations or other means, and then you can move on together. And that has to be part of our American story moving forward, or it will come back to haunt us in forms like Donald Trump and other ways that we haven't even imagined.
Jonathan, the first step to acknowledging that history is learning the history. Discussing this earlier. I went to a very good public high school in America and was not taught about the Tulsa race massacre that took place 100 years ago today. President Biden traveling to Tulsa where he's going to make a speech, not just ceremonial. He's also going to introduce some new policy changes that get at the root of what happened that day.
Right. And what you said, Willie, is the main event, is that the idea that this is a shameful and forgotten moment in American history, one that I didn't learn about in school either, that this is something that has been, not given it all the attention it deserves. So the president, yes, he has some policy he's going to announce in Tulsa today, federal initiatives to try to address the disparities in the value of Black-owned homes, going to try to help out Black-owned small businesses. But it's as much as it is about the policy, it's about giving the presidential spotlight. Joe Biden will be the first president to travel to Tulsa to mark the anniversary of this massacre. He will be there to acknowledge, the pain felt by the people, the survivors, yes, but also their descendants and others in that community, displaced, a community destroyed 100 years ago. We know that President Biden speaks on the topic of grief and shows empathy like no other political figure in American history. And we should note the contrast between his predecessor, who just over a year ago chose Tulsa as the site of his comeback rally, his first rally after the pandemic came in, and who was going to have it on Juneteenth, even the commemoration to mark the end of slavery. They eventually moved the date by a day. He saw a rally of arena full of empty seats, but there were protests that greeted him outside and a real divisive message. That's the exact opposite of what Biden is trying to do today.
You know, Maura, I love how you talked about how
we need to acknowledge this. We need to, as a country, we need to understand this. It doesn't mean that the American experiment is derailed. So many people, when they start hearing people talking about what happened 100 years ago or 300 years ago, will take that as an affront to the American experiment. I'll tell you, just as in Congress, there is now a generation that doesn't have the connective tissue of fighting together for democracy against, let's say, Hitler. You take people like myself, and I've said this before on the show an awful lot. My first year in school was in Meridian, Mississippi. I grew up in the Deep South, and I was the first class that was integrated. And I went to a public school, and we were out in the country in Meridian, Mississippi. Going to school with black and white kids, that was normal to me. I remember when Barack Obama was elected president, there were people older than me that were weeping, white guys that were weeping, who, truthfully, some of them had never really seen a black person until they went to college. And I said, wait, what are you weeping about? I went to law school with that guy. Not that guy, but people like Barack Obama. So it wasn't a huge shock for me. And I'm older. There are a lot of people younger than me, white people younger than me, maybe people of other races younger than me, that just took it for granted that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it always bends towards freedom, towards liberty, towards justice. And we got a stark reminder over the past 5 years that that's just not an assumption that we can make. And so there is, talk about connective tissue, there is a connection between people that fought in a war together and then those today that don't know what it's like actually fighting for liberty. And also, my friend John Lewis, a good friend of mine, and Jim Clyburn, a good friend of mine in Congress, I sat and I talked to him and I said, oh, wow, you got that. But there's no way I could ever understand that. There's no way so many Americans could ever understand what those civil rights leaders went through or what all the black Americans went through 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago and what so many are still fighting for today and still going through today.
It's remarkable. It just wasn't that long ago. I say this, my father lived in South Carolina as a kid. It lived in segregated society. Yesterday, I posted a digitized video on Twitter that I love that is of my great uncle marching through the streets of Detroit in a segregated army battalion on his way to go fight fascists and fascism in Europe. And then, of course, he came home and faced extraordinary discrimination after defeating Nazis abroad. And I just think these are the stories that America is living with that much of America doesn't want to acknowledge. And when you have that kind of inheritance and you don't acknowledge it, it will come for you. It will come for you in ways that you can't explain, that you don't understand, and ways that really destroy and tear at the fabric of democracy. I mean, one of the things that we really, I hope, can start to understand is that Black Americans, the struggle that we've had over the hundreds of years in this country for recognition as human beings and as citizens, there's a direct link between the status of our citizenship and the status and health of our democracy. And so the movement for equal justice for Black Americans, also for Native Americans, for women, is at the very heart of whether this is a democracy and an experiment that will work or that won't. And that is what is at stake right now. And of course, it's an inclusive vision. It's not just Black Americans. It's just, this is what we need to understand. We need to start talking about how to talk about this instead of trying to avoid talking about it.
You know, Mara, you're right. And I would submit that before we can talk about this really collectively as a country, as a people, we're going to have to learn about it. We don't know about these things in America. It's not taught. Tulsa is not taught really in schools. It might be now, but it hadn't been for years and years and years. You could take a picture of what happened in Hiroshima and match it up against a picture of what happened in Tulsa 100 years ago, and it would be hard to tell the difference. And the difference, of course, is rooted in race. We just don't grasp the meaning of race in this country because it's not taught in our schools. Our children really don't know the meaning of race in this country because it's just not taught.
Mika, we've been playing catch up trying to educate ourselves as a country over the last few years about this horrible massacre in Tulsa. And since Mara's here, I'll give a plug. The New York Times interactive reporting on this is just extraordinary. It takes you block by block, business by business, hour by hour through those terrible 24 hours. I can't recommend it enough if you do want to educate yourself about what happened.
What a great conversation this morning. And still ahead on Morning Joe, there is more. The latest out of Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott is threatening to withhold lawmakers' pay after Democrats blocked a controversial voting bill. Plus, my exclusive sit-down interview with Vice President Kamala Harris. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
The city that never sleeps, I guess. New York City, home of your and TJ's New York Mets, Willie Geist, last night. Was DeGrom night in America. He did it again. The man that Mike Lupica calls the best pitcher since Sandy Koufax, our Sandy Koufax, had another extraordinary night.
Yeah, he just shut down the D-backs out in Arizona. I think Mike can correct me, but his first 10 pitches, at least, were over 100 miles an hour. So the last night was May 31st. So he ends the month of May with the lowest ERA by a pitcher through the month of May since 1964. His ERA, Mike, is 0.71. And let's remember, he's doing this without any run support. He got a little last night, but generally, Mets don't score any runs for him.
He's in Bob Gibson territory with the ERA. I mean, his ERA obviously is well under the league ERA average. It's Pedro Martinez, Bob Gibson territory.
Wow. Yeah, the Pedro comparison is right on. He did it, of course, at the height of the steroid era. But what DeGrom doing is right now is just remarkable. And I'll also note, he had a hit last night. In addition to pitching masterfully, he's also hitting .450 for the season.
Yeah.
The guy can do it all. He got MVP chance last night on the road.
Wow.
They make sense.
That's amazing.
There's other news that also is in the sports world.
Look at that.
The first round of French Open tennis competition continues this morning, but all attention remains on women's superstar Naomi Osaka. Despite her efforts to stay out of the spotlight, the four-time Grand Slam champion has withdrawn from the French Open, writing on Twitter that she will be taking a break from competition. One day after Osaka was fined and threatened with harsher sanctions for her skipping the mandatory media obligations, the 23-year-old revealed that she experiences, quote, huge waves of anxiety before speaking to the media, and said she has, quote, suffered long bouts of depression. I thought this was interesting. It generated a lot of debate on Twitter, some people actually being rather negative toward her. But it fits into a narrative that I've been following for a long time now. Two strains of conversation. Number one, Mental health is really important, and it is okay to step off and take some time to work for it. I really applaud her for doing that on the international stage, showing people that you can walk away when you need to. And then secondly, for young women, you've got such a long runway. You can let life interrupt you a little bit, and you can come back. I just thought her message was very clear, very poignant, and a great example in many ways.
Yeah, you know, it is, we just don't talk about mental health enough in this country, and we haven't for a long time, and not just in this country, across the world. It's something that people have started to talk to. I think the pandemic has brought us a lot closer to addressing it more straightforward and head on, which we've been trying to do on this show. And I know other shows have been trying to do that as well. You know, Mike Barnicle, though, we just assume, you know, it's sort of the fans just assume somebody decides they want to go into a sport and they make a lot of money from that sport. They win a lot of trophies. They get a lot of fame. They're superstars. You know, and so many people are like, you owe it to me to do the press conference. You owe it to me for this. You owe it to me for that. And we just never take it. As too many people just never consider how difficult it is for a young woman, a young man, first of all, to endure like every second, understanding that they don't ever have a second of themselves again. But also, if you're suffering with depression or anxiety before that happens, how paralyzing it would be for a young man or a young woman, possibly, to stand in front of reporters. It's one thing, you know, when you talk to a lot of people who say, hey, I'm great in front of 50,000 people if I'm playing, you know, playing my songs. But if I'm in front of 5 or 10 people, you know, even superstars will say they freeze up. And so for some 23, 24 year old, I'll say it because I've got kids older than that kid. Sometimes expectations are just too heavy, too burdensome. And we need to let people take a break. Sometime and give them a break.
Well, this issue, Joe, is particularly enhanced for professional athletes because we see them on TV. We see them when we go to the ballpark or to Forest Hills for the U.S. Open here or wherever, Wimbledon, wherever. And we see them and their gifts, their talents are God-given. They are magical. They separate them from us. We know growing up we played baseball, whatever. There's no way that we are at that level. Very few people are at that level. So when that happens, and with all the collective tools we have today at our disposal, our phones, the video components of our phones, the Instagram stuff and everything like that, we get to think that we actually know them, and they are ours. And why are you doing this? Why are you quitting on this game? You know, I've got money on you. I bet on your serve that last round because you can bet instantly now with things like that. So, you know, you were right. I mean, we don't give them the space that a normal human being would get because we have put them on pedestals and they don't belong on pedestals.
Yeah. I mean, and not everybody wants to be on camera like us weirdos. No, I mean, it's just this is hard for some people. And for some people, it's a matter of, you know, being able to do what they do or not. Mara, I know it probably seems naive, but I sometimes wonder why do they have to do the press conference? I mean, what does that impact their game? Why couldn't she make a statement or something, read something, and show up and then not have to participate in the stress of the press conferences? Here we're losing a great player because she was required to show up and answer questions from like 50 people. I don't know. Straight on, that seems like an incredibly stressful situation for anyone, but I guess it's part of the sport that comes with it.
Yeah, you know, we don't talk about mental health enough, but we also seem to have as a society a sense of like ownership over some of these athletes. And I think it's really unfair. But behind the scenes, there's often a lot more going on, and you just have to wonder, and I have no idea, were they able to actually help her at these appearances? Did she get any support or training? You know, was she forced to kind of endure dozens of questions at a time? I mean, I actually was behind the scenes with the women's soccer team at the, you know, after they won the World Cup there. And, you know, they came to City Hall in New York. It was really a great day. We had a ticker tape parade for them. But they came with minders. And, you know, we had just ordinary kids, women, young women coming up to them. Can you sign my soccer ball? And they weren't allowed to do it. And they were, everything was very rigid and orchestrated. And it's like, this should be fun. And they're human. We're all human. So let's give some grace for people. So I don't know what's going on behind the scenes there.
Yeah, Mika, that was one of the things she said, Osaka, in her statement, was that we, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm sorry to disappoint all the fans and the people at the French Open, but I do want to talk to the WTA and talk to tennis about how we help people like myself with this side of it. So hopefully this will be taken as an opportunity to make those strides. The first thing to say, though, she is a phenomenal player. She's won a couple of the majors. She is a radiant star. She's got all kinds of endorsements. She's got everything going for her. So let's hope she takes this time away and keeps moving in the direction she's been going. But it is, I think, good when somebody this prominent talks about anxiety in a way that even 5 years ago, I can't remember people talking about it because it was seen almost as a sign of weakness. And if you're that big a star, people can't conceive of that in you. How could you possibly have anxiety? How could you even feel the pressure? It never appears you do on the court. But as Joe was saying about rock stars, we're lucky enough, and I'm lucky enough on my Sunday show to interview some of the biggest stars you can think of. And I assure you that to a man and to a woman, they are nervous wrecks before an easy interview with me. And it's people, I don't think people realize that. I mean, there is an anxiety that undergirds a lot of what people have to do in public life. So I'm glad she's talking about it, and I know she'll continue to be a huge star in sports.
Well, I think what was really strong was to walk away elegantly like that. Yeah. That took strength. We're going to turn back to politics now and an update on the fight over controversial new voting legislation in Texas. Democrats were able to temporarily stop the passage of the new voting bill on Sunday by walking out before the vote deadline. But in a statement following the end of the legislative session, Republican Governor Abbott called the vote bill a must-pass emergency item and promised to add it to a special session.
Wait a second.
Just double down.
Emergency item when actually...
Yes, it's an emergency to Texas him that black people want to vote.
A Texas congressman said that there was actually no irregularities, that this was for optics only. So Jonathan Lemire, of course, Texas Democrats are now saying the Democrats in the Senate need to do something with H.R. 1 and H.R. 4. But again, just the preposterousness of this, where nobody is alleging widespread voting fraud. Abbott never alleged widespread voting fraud. There was a New York Times Magazine article that we talked about where, you know, even Alan West was saying, stop talking about some Italian dude coming to Texas stealing the election. It's all a sham. It's all about optics. It's all about cleaning up a mess that Donald Trump and the Republicans created themselves by lying, the big lie. And they're talking about, now Governor Abbott's talking about, quote, an emergency, a must-pass bill.
Because racism is showing.
This is just preposterous.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
It's rare when Alan West is the voice of reason, Joe. We're seeing this now. This battle over voting rights goes state by state. Abbott also said he wanted to pass a measure that would strip the legislators of their pay, would prevent them from being paid because of what they're doing here. But this all does feel like the undercards, right, for the main event, which is going to be the federal legislation, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, other measures that Congress is supposed to take up likely later this summer. And that is, we know, that is going to be an extraordinary important moment, and both sides, Democrats, Republicans, are girding up for it. Mitch McConnell was in committee, doing committee work a few weeks ago on this, speaking out against the idea of expanding voting rights, which shows you how seriously he and other Republicans are taking this. And that's also partially why this president, who knows about, from his time in the Senate, knows about the sequencing of legislation, is trying to do everything else first, trying to do infrastructure first, ahead of whether, because they know how the pitched battle will be over voting rights. There's a hope there can be maybe a bipartisan agreement on this, because there certainly won't be on the voting rights issue. And that, more than anything else, is where the future of the filibuster is in doubt, Willie.
As John just mentioned, Texas Democrats are calling on Democrats in Washington to do more to protect voting rights. After defeating the voting bill, one Texas lawmaker called on the president to push for a national strategy, and another called on Congress to, quote, do their part. Joining us now, co-founder of Punchbowl News, Anna Palmer. She is an MSNBC contributor. Anna, it's good to see you this morning. So it took this last straw stunt for Democrats to walk out and deny Republicans a quorum to stop the bill, for now at least, in the state of Texas. What is happening in the Congress, though, on Capitol Hill in terms of voting rights? What's the future of these pieces of legislation?
Yeah, I think Jonathan laid that out pretty well. But basically, we're all looking to July. Chuck Schumer has said that that is when he plans to bring H.R. 1, this kind of massive bill that would deal with a lot of the voting rights issues at the federal level that we've seen prop up in many of these different states where conservative legislatures are trying to peel back some of the voting rights. At this point, there is no support in the Republican Party in the Senate to try to kind of forge some kind of agreement on this Voting Rights Act that Schumer is going to try to force a vote on at the end of July. The question really is going to be, I think, is this going to be the issue that tees up the end of the filibuster? Will you see senators like a Joe Manchin support this or not? So far, it doesn't appear that there is that enthusiasm or appetite to try to take this up and say this is going to be the issue that the filibuster is going to blow up over. But they are willing to take the vote, and that is something that you're going to see Chuck Schumer force.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand for the life of me. I just, quick editorial side note here. H.R. 1 is a train wreck waiting to happen. I have no idea, Anna, why they don't start with John Lewis's H.R. 4. People I talk to on the Hill say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That seems to make a lot of sense. Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema and a lot of other Democrats. Now, this is sort of the dirty secret. A lot of other Democrats are just sitting back and letting Manchin take a lot of the flack for things that they don't especially love themselves. And he doesn't mind it. I think, in fact, he probably likes it. You know, Anna, I don't understand why they don't just move on H.R. 4, the John Lewis voting rights bill. It's going to be a lot more difficult for Republicans to vote no on that. I'm sure they will. But still, it's a lot cleaner shot at voting rights. And it's following through on the legacy of one of the great civil rights heroes of our time. And it makes a difference immediately. The Supreme Court actually guided Congress to do this several years ago. So why don't they just walk through that door? H.R. 4, so much cleaner than H.R. 1.
Yeah, you've seen Senator Joe Manchin say that he would support that along with Lisa Murkowski. I mean, there isn't going to be big bipartisan support. I think that is just fundamentally where the Republican Party is. And if particularly when you look at where Mitch McConnell is, he is not going to let his members vote for this. This is not going to be a vote of conscience like we do see on some of these other issues. I think Chuck Schumer has clearly stuck his line in the sand. The H.R. 1 is where he is going to put his political backing, and that's what's going to happen moving forward. And that's going to be the issue he's going to push forward in July. It's not going to be the John Lewis voting bill.
Yeah, and Maura, at what point does Joe Manchin understand that the Republicans are just they're not going to give him that bipartisan vote that he's looking for. He's not going to find those 10 Republicans. And if he keeps looking for those 10 Republicans, he's going to at some point look like Linus in the pumpkin patch waiting for the great pumpkin to rise. Mm-hmm. It's not coming.
Yeah, it's not coming. But in the meantime, he still appears to be holding the cards, even if it's not just him holding them. So this is a win-win for him in some ways. At some point, he will have to deliver something. But I think actually the way forward for Democrats is to, I continue to believe that they need to fight for voting rights on all fronts. But one of those mechanisms is to take the case directly to the American people. I think this is something that Joe Biden needs to take on personally. I think he needs to try and convince folks in swing states that this is actually a pivotal issue for democracy that is important to them, not just to people in cities or people on the coasts or people who don't look like them. I think that that direct Democratic appeal might be the way forward, because there's no political courage among Republicans in Washington.
And Jonathan Lemire, just so I want to be clear when I talk about Democrats standing behind Joe Manchin, letting him take the flak. We've talked about this before, that right now it's Joe Manchin who's saying hell no to the filibuster, ending the filibuster. And it is a win. It works for him in West Virginia, a state 69% of West Virginians voted for Donald Trump in 2020. But also it works for a lot of Senate Democrats who have told you and me and other people, hey, they're just not comfortable with ending the filibuster. So if Manchin wants to take the flak, that's fine. But push came to shove, they would be very, very uncomfortable ending the filibuster, too. These are several Democrats that are sort of standing behind Joe Manchin while he takes the flak.
That's right. First of all, I don't think Manchin minds the attention. He's sort of happy to be the star of the show here. But, yes, certainly, I've had conversations with Democratic senators who also say that they're not quite willing to go there. Even on an issue on voting rights, they think that maybe they'd end up, if there is any filibuster reform, it would be more of a talking filibuster. So, Anna, I wanted to get your sense on that, just how endangered is the filibuster really this summer, and also provide us an update on the ongoing infrastructure talks. So Congress is out this week, but the president has sort of targeted, the Memorial Day deadline has come and gone, but he's targeted now, I believe, the week of June 7th, so coming up, as sort of his new deadline to see whether or not there could be any sort of bipartisan deal on infrastructure.
So on the first part, I'll just say, I think that you are totally right. You and Joe both are. There are many senators that do not want the filibuster to end. They are just much more quiet about it. I think you have a lot of votes that there are moderate Democrats in states like Arizona, Georgia, et cetera, that would have problems voting for some of these issues that they don't want to have to take up. As far as infrastructure, we're reporting this morning that Joe Biden is set to meet with Shelley Moore Capito, the Republican from West Virginia, who's leading the Senate Republican side of things tomorrow. Now, I think it's important to just note that they are very, very far apart. The talks are continuing. Joe Biden wants to find some way forward, but they aren't even in the same page on what actually infrastructure means at this point. And they're really, really far apart when it comes to the actual monetary amount. So, yes, they are looking towards next week in the Biden administration to find some pathway forward. Is there going to be some momentum? I'm very skeptical that they are able to get there. I think the real question is going to be, when do Democrats turn to just say, we're going to go it alone? And the fact that reconciliation and finding way forward just on by Democrats alone is also going to be difficult. I think a lot of people say, like, oh, we're just going to dump Republicans. It's time for Democrats to get it together. That's going to be extremely difficult.
Anna Palmer of Punch Bowl News, thank you very much for being on this morning. And we want to turn to something we've been gearing up toward for several weeks now, really months. The women over the age of 50 who are really having their moment right now. Forbes and Know Your Value have teamed up for a special 50 over 50 initiative to celebrate women who have achieved notable success at midlife and way beyond. For these remarkable, dynamic women growing older, older is about getting stronger, wiser, better, bolder, more confident. Tomorrow on Morning Joe, you will meet the full inaugural class of entrepreneurs, leaders, and creators who make up the first 50 over 50 list selected from over 10,000 nominees. But before tomorrow's reveal this morning, we will launch the list and announce one of the women who has landed right there on the list, Vice President Kamala Harris. She's also one of the four women on the cover of Forbes magazine, first ever inclusive capitalism special issue, which looks at how societal change can ensure everyone has equal access and an equal chance to achieve success. As part of the issue, the vice president wrote an exclusive essay to really launch the list about the importance of reimagining entrepreneurship and small business in the United States, which reads in part, "When I was in the U.S. Senate, I worked to secure an additional $12 billion for community lenders. Now we are working to build on that investment. Together, we must help every American entrepreneur get the capital they need to realize their vision." And she goes on to write, "For women entrepreneurs and all entrepreneurs, the pandemic has highlighted the importance of our nation's care infrastructure. The full essay is online right now at Forbes.com. You can read it. But next hour on Morning Joe, launching the list, we will play for you my exclusive sit-down with the vice president, where she talks more about how the administration plans on getting those hit hardest by the pandemic, particularly women and women of color, back on track. And once again, the vice president is one of 50 women on this exciting new 50 over 50 list. You will meet them all tomorrow when we announce the full list of women who are rewriting the rules of success, shattering the prevailing misconceptions about age and gender in the workforce, and inspiring women and men of all ages through all stages of their careers.
You know, Mika, I've seen you and Randall, and I've seen this list as it's been coming together, and the women that you've talked to and interviewed, and we're there's so much. I mean, it's remarkable, so much that has happened. Let's just talk about 50 over 50. But over the past 50 years, you look at where women were 50 years ago in the workforce. You look where they were 25 years ago in the workforce, and look where they are now. It's just been an extraordinary sea change. And women are running, well, certainly in Europe, actually, even more so than America, but it's starting to happen dramatically in America. But women running militaries, women running banks, women actually running economies, women in the United States running economies, running corporations. Again, the sea change in 25 years, the sea change even in the past decade, really has been something to behold.
Well, and the interesting message here is that these accomplishments, these highest achievements of their lives are happening in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, which is an amazing message for younger women, that you can plan your life. You can. We were talking about Naomi Osaka. You can walk off the field and come back on. And you know what? Your days aren't numbered to the age of 40. It's now going way past 80. And you'll see when this list is revealed. Leading off the list this morning, though, Vice President Kamala Harris. And we'll be showing that interview.
And they're all trailblazers. What that means with that change is everybody on this list is a trailblazer.
Coming up, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb will be our guest, plus the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison. Morning Joe is coming right back.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.